Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. Jason Croft is at the controls, and our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. In the fall of 2001 in Afghanistan, New York Times correspondent David Rode was one of the first reporters to reach Kabul during the defeat of the Taliban. Since then, promises to rebuild Afghanistan have floundered, and the Taliban have reemerged as a major factor in the country. Opium production has returned to record levels, and the Afghan government is challenged by widespread corruption and daily violence. NATO has taken over military and security operations and has become a target of complaints over Afghan civilian deaths. We should also mention political upheaval across the border in Pakistan, which could bring even more instability to the region. With so much of our attention focused on the war in Iraq, it seems little is left for Afghanistan. That's our cue here on Focus 580 to shed whatever light we can on the subject and try to bring things up to date. So during this hour of Focus 580, we will talk with David Rode, who is literally just back from Afghanistan, where he continues to report for the New York Times. He's now special correspondent, actually investigative reporter for the New York Times, and he spent a lot of the last few years in Afghanistan, also Iraq, and various other places. As we talk with David Rode, your questions are welcome. All you have to do to join us is pick up your telephone, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere in the Midwest, or actually if you're listening online, anywhere in the continental U.S., 800-222-9455. A bit more about our guest. During the war in former Yugoslavia, David Rode was the first Westerner to inspect one of the grave sites near the former UN safe area of Srebrenica, and his reporting for the Christian Science Monitor exposed the massacre of thousands of Bosnian Muslims. His reports on Srebrenica earned him numerous professional honors, including the George Polk Prize, the Overseas Press Club Award, and the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. His book Endgame, The Betrayal and Fall of Srebrenica, was published in 1997, and we spoke with him on that about that book at that time. And we're glad to have him back on the show by telephone. David Rode, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Well, we appreciate your time a great deal. We hear a lot about Iraq, as I alluded to, and how difficult it is for Western journalists to report there. What is it like for you now reporting in Afghanistan, and how has that changed, perhaps, over the years?
Well, there's been a dramatic change since 2001 in terms of the levels of security, particularly last year, there was a drastic change where there was a very large Taliban offensive. The number of suicide bombings in the country increased sixfold, and the Taliban actually threatened to take Kandahar, which is the largest city in the south. It's now much more dangerous to travel around the country. What hasn't changed, though, drastically yet, is the support among Afghans for change there and for support from the international community. There still isn't much support for the Taliban, but there's sort of growing frustration with the inability of the U.S. and its allies to sort of finish off the Taliban and stabilize the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, what can you tell us about the resurgence of the Taliban? Is the Taliban trying to regain control over large areas of the country? To what extent are they succeeding? And, you know, who exactly are these? Is it the same Taliban, or what do they consist of?
In terms of the ebb and flow of the fight, again, the Taliban were sort of a small presence, mostly targeting aid workers, again, through 2005. In 2006, they took large areas of territory. Groups of hundreds of Taliban were sort of moving around the south in particular. This year, they've sort of been slowed by NATO and U.S. forces. And it's much more of a sort of protracted guerrilla struggle now. The Taliban aren't really engaging in direct combat very much with NATO and American forces. They're relying much more on roadside bomb and suicide attacks, which does increase Western casualties, but they're not strong enough to take large towns. They're sort of no man's lands in rural areas that the government doesn't control and the Taliban doesn't control. They roam through those areas. But they are weaker this summer than last summer, but still a serious problem. And then in terms of who they are, they've kind of broadened into a much a sort of hodgepodge of different groups. With the slow pace of reconstruction, you have local Afghan sort of leaders and tribes and even individuals who've developed grievances against the government or American forces, let's say, if they were detained wrongly at one time. So you've got a really hardcore, older Taliban guard that's much more ideological and brutal in terms of carrying out assassinations. There was one example earlier this year where girls attending a school were machine-gunned by hardcore Taliban and some foreign fighters aligned with them. But there's a more moderate sort of practical element now that are kind of, and some criminals as well that have kind of joined them in a sort of broader anti-government movement.
Mm-hmm. I want to follow up on that in a minute. We do have somebody on a cell phone who has dialed in immediately, so let's include them in our conversation. We'll go to that person on line number one. Good morning.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what seems to be the U.S.'s problem in this area. It seems to me that even well before the Taliban took power, back when the Soviets were fighting in Afghanistan, and we were helping out the Mujahideen, we dropped the ball in this area over and over and over again, when it seems like every time we seem to get a little bit ahead, and it seems like we have a chance to make friends, we seem to screw it up. What is the problem? Why do we keep doing that?
The Afghans very much have the sense that you just described, that the U.S. was very interested in Afghanistan and spending billions there to defeat the Soviets, and then once the Soviets withdrew in 1989, they feel we abandoned them. So, you know, why that happened is a long and political debate, but in terms of, would they expect us to abandon them again? The Taliban are kind of sitting back, and again, you know, the slow guerrilla, you know, warfare, and they think time is on their side, and Afghans and Pakistanis as well don't really trust us. The American military, I was just on a recent embed there, are optimistic. They think that things are going much better this year than last year. And Afghans are sort of on the fence, waiting to see whether we're really, you know, we'll keep our promises and keep at this for several more years.
I mean, it seemed to me that at one time we even could have headed off things like the problems we're having with Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden if we had just stayed the course in Afghanistan originally.
Yeah, there's sense
maybe
that
I'm missing something.
That, I mean, we, you know, Osama bin Laden received, you know, funding from the U.S. in the 80s. He was one of the foreign fighters that was fighting the Soviets. And we, you know, the U.S. did support the growth of sort of hardline religious schools and a really hardline version of Islam that wasn't really natural for the region, that was a tool against the Soviets, and it sort of spun out of control. And, you know, there's a lot of questions about that policy, and then you're correct about a lot of criticism of U.S. from walking away, and we sort of created this Frankenstein, and it's come back to haunt us now.
You know, I wonder, this raises for me our short attention spans as a nation. And it's a question that I was planning to get to later in the program, but it seems relevant that, you know, all I read about many people around the world, and especially in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and, you know, the Middle East, is that their sense of history is very alive and real, that they know their history, and somehow we don't. And it seems that kind of gets us into trouble time and time again.
We do kind of rush in. There's sort of one of the great things about the U.S. is that sort of can-do sense of Americanism, that we're going to get in there and really sort of engage. And that can sometimes lead us to kind of rush in and not think things through clearly, and then we do expect immediate results. And then this is sort of, again, related but aside, you know, I did speak to American soldiers who said they wish that more Americans could see, I guess, the scale of the poverty and destruction in Afghanistan after all these years of war. And one of them, and this was not a universal thing, but one of them did say they felt like the joke was that the army has gone to war and the country has gone to the mall. and a sense that much of the rest of the society isn't as sort of invested or making as many sacrifices as the military.
Mm-hmm. I want to return to the issue of who the Taliban are and what are they doing at this point. There were stories, and you know, again, being over here in the States, I can't really tell to what extent these stories describe the overall reality in Afghanistan. But before 2001, that the Taliban came into power and were appreciated by a lot of people in the sense that they restored order to a war-torn country, that they established services, and they weren't as corrupt, perhaps, as the other, you know, governmental entities. And we're hearing these stories again that the Taliban are coming in and essentially trying to reestablish some sense of normalcy. And I wonder if that's your perception there, or what is real with regard to how they are behaving.
It's a very accurate description of their initial rise. I mean, what happened largely in the 80s was we funded all of these different warlords and Arab fighters, including bin Laden, and then we sort of walked away, and a very vicious civil war erupted as these commanders fought for control of the country, and there was tremendous criminality and disorder, frankly, on the level of what's, you know, emerged in Iraq today. And, you know, all told, 1 million people perished between the Soviet invasion and the civil war that ravaged Afghanistan for more than 20 years. It was tremendous bloodletting. And the Taliban moved in, did offer law and order and some security, and they were welcomed at first, but then they sort of became overzealous and, you know, lost a lot of their popularity by you know, really jailing all their opponents and getting corrupt in their own ways. And so they're again offering that promise of law and order, but there's a real skepticism from Afghans. They've kind of lived under you know, a hardline Islamic regime, and, you know, the promise of sort of strict Islamic law, they know, didn't produce, you know, there are very basic things Afghans are looking for that are very similar to what Americans would look for, and they didn't produce sort of steady jobs, you know, good schools for their kids, and, you know, like decent, honest policemen. And what exists today is the Taliban offering all that, saying that they can bring it back again, and then the U.S. saying, well, a form of Western democracy can bring that as well. And the Afghans aren't quite sure who's going to deliver. And we've been slow in delivering the sort of stability and prosperity that they expected.
Our guest this morning during this hour, Focus 580, is David Rode, investigative journalist for The New York Times, who has been reporting from Afghanistan for some time. He's back in the States and apparently is writing a book about his reporting in Afghanistan later. You can see many of his reports in The New York Times. And we have several callers waiting. We'll get right to them. Let me just mention the phone numbers again. Around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Next up, a listener in Charleston, line number 4. Good morning.
Yes, I have a question and a comment, if I might. I heard you say, your guest say, finish off the Taliban. Can you elaborate on that? Finished off by whom and why?
I'm not sure I remember the context of that.
I heard you say that, sir.
No, it's a correct, it's actually a term Afghans say. They were really almost awed by the sort of strength of American military power in 2001 and how quickly the U.S. were able to topple the Taliban as a regime. And so the question, you know, I was asked repeatedly was, how come these guys still exist as a guerrilla movement? How come the United States wasn't able to sort of create a much stronger Afghan government that could be out and operating in rural areas where the Taliban remain? And I guess that's the sense I get from Afghans, is that they don't want suicide bombings and, you know, assassinations of local officials. And, you know, how can the U.S. and NATO not be able to stop the Taliban?
Well, my comment is, you know, finish off has been an international practice of the U.S., even here, when the Native Americans and the introduction of slaves and finishing off this one or that one with whom they do not agree. I want to take you back to 1974 in Lebanon. A huge vacuum was created there when Nixon was still president, 73 or 4, whenever that occurred, but it was the 70s, and the place turned into chaos. And then who arrived was the Syrians and established order, and the place began to rebuild. Ronald Reagan sent, I don't know if you remember that Marine base there, a fellow in a little truck drove up and wiped the place out, and the Marines were killed and all that sort of thing. Well, my take on all this is that U.S. foreign policy, and then now with the neocons and the spreading of democracy, what a hateful term. You know, you're going to do this. We're going to run it down your throat. You're going to like it. And if you don't, we're going to eliminate you. And all this keeps going on and on in the name of anti-terrorism. Why in the hell do people think that those twin towers went down? A bunch of opium smokers got together and said, well, I think we can get this done. I mean, that day, what happened? 9/11, which is the emergency number, they hit the business center and the military, which made a statement from these people who have no Navy, no Air Force, no standing armies. What are they to do? The countries are in turmoil. Their natural resources being sucked out of there at cheap price for nothing. And then suddenly, and it's happening all over the world. I cannot see any verification except the negative for what is going on in the world today. And there's going to be more and more. And where will it end? Thank you.
All right. Well, a little passion there. And certainly some real issues in the sense that, you know, the course we pursued, certainly, you know, as we see in Iraq, has not turned out the way that it was planned.
I mean, I would just say that, in all honesty, there is still a desire among Afghans for change and some sort of self-determination, a government where they can hold their own leaders accountable. They don't want, you know, an American version of democracy there, but they also don't support the Taliban. This was a brutal, repressive regime that used religion for political gain. I mean, Afghans are extremely religious people and want to live in an Islamic country, but they don't want to be, you know, ruled by a group of self-appointed religious leaders, which is what the Taliban were. And that's just genuine. That's existed since 2001, and I still hear that today. And Afghanistan is different from Iraq in that there is not oil. There's not a large amount of resources there. That's very clear.
Yeah, and so what you say is, you know, the contrast between Iraq and Afghanistan is rather stark in the sense that, you know, the Iraqis don't want us there, but the Afghanis do, and yet there we are in Iraq, and we're not so much in Afghanistan.
It's true. I mean, and I've spent less time in Iraq. I mean, there's. I think the Iraqis don't want us there, but there's also fears there of civil war. And I know much less about Iraq, but it's a difficult situation there as well. There's concerns in Afghanistan that if the U.S. completely withdraws from Iraq, many of the foreign fighters in Iraq will then shift over to Afghanistan. So it's not quite as simple as, you know, we just leave Iraq and focus on Afghanistan. You know, there's very large, you know, beyond the debate of whether or not we should have invaded, it's a very difficult situation in Iraq today, and it's not easy to walk away from there either, based on what I've seen myself and what my colleagues who report there more regularly have told me.
We have another caller waiting. Let's include them in our conversation. This is an Urbana listener, line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. Would you comment on my belief that the military-industrial complex does not want the war in Afghanistan to end? Because if they did, they would not plow under the indigent farmers' primary source of income and leave them with no substitute crop or a poor substitute, which takes a lot more labor at a lot less profit. I mean, it doesn't take a scientist to realize that if you destroy a farmer's livelihood, he's going to lean to the other side of the conflict.
The poppy crop, I mean, Afghans, the Afghan government and even Afghan farmers say that they it's against Islam to grow the poppy, and it's generally seen as a hugely corrupting influence in the country. There's also frustration among Afghans about the West doesn't decrease its demand for poppy, but there hasn't, I mean, most of the eradication that's happened so far has been carried out by Afghans, but obviously the U.S. does support eradication. There are very weak alternative livelihoods programs. It's correct that the U.S. isn't doing enough to give farmers other alternatives, but I think that Afghans themselves don't see, you know, drug production as the way to establish a stable country and stable economy in the long term. You know, they wish there was more support to create, you know, more legal crops. There is a huge market for them in India for lots of fruits and other things they grow there, but they wish they had more American help changing over from poppy.
Opium cultivation, you report it grew by 17% this year, reaching record levels for the second straight year. And Afghanistan now accounts for 93% of the world's opium production, which is just an astonishing thing to read. We are engaged in a counter-narcotics effort, spending some $600 million a year. What does this consist of? What actually is the counter-narcotics effort, and how does it work?
What's happened is that, again, in the once the Taliban were toppled and there were these rural areas that really the government hasn't been able to extend into, farmers have just started growing huge amounts of opium because it's much more profitable. It's now gotten to the point where it's beyond economic necessity. According to the UN, it's people trying to make as much profit as they can. And it's... In terms of the U.S., the new U.S. strategy, it's the same one they've used in Latin America, many argue without much success, which would be you offer alternative livelihoods, have a, in terms of other crops, have a credible threat that your crop will be eradicated if you grow poppy, and also targeting traffickers who make the vast majority of the money from the trade. The success stories they point to is that in Burma or Myanmar, as it's called now, there was a reduction in poppy growth there, that Pakistan has had a reduction over the last 20 years. You know, Latin America is, you know, it's a more checkered record. And there's one last thing in terms of the scale of what's happening in Afghanistan. There's now more acres in Afghanistan growing poppy than there is acres across all of Latin America growing coca. It's now a bigger drug producer than all of the Latin American countries that are producing raw cocaine. So it's a staggering amount of drug production, and you know, when there's no, you know, government presence in rural areas, you know, people have been able to grow it.
One proposal is to use chemical spraying, but there's opposition to that from Afghan officials.
There's a sense, and this is what the caller referred to, that that'll just drive Afghan farmers right into supporting the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
The Taliban, interestingly, banned poppy themselves 1 year. It is seen as against Islam. Islam, you know, in its more severe and strict forms, you know, opposes it. It opposes drinking of alcohol as well. So that religious message is on the side of the government here as well. And the Taliban supporting it now, it's seen as more of an opportunistic thing. But, you know, so there has been opposition from the government until this year for spraying. There's talk of a compromise instead of spraying from airplanes, maybe having ground crews go out and spray from the ground might be used this spring. But it's a huge issue that hasn't been resolved yet.
We're just about at our midpoint here with David Rode, investigative journalist for the New York Times. We're talking about his reporting from Afghanistan. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. I wanted to ask about a particular connection that Actually, the University of Illinois recently had the University of Illinois Police Training Institute, the head of that, recently resigned following revelations about his consulting work with Blackwater and the Institute's relationship with that company. He was in Afghanistan during July and August doing something with Blackwater associated with opium eradication. And, of course, Blackwater is the same company that in Iraq has stirred up quite a bit of opposition because of civilian deaths in a most recent incident, and has apparently, you know, perhaps been banned from the country, or there's been, you know, sort of signals that it is very precarious. And Blackwater is in Afghanistan as well, and I wonder if you have any, you know, information about what they're doing there and how they're being received.
I know they have the main contract to guard American diplomats in Afghanistan. That's the same contract they have in Iraq that led to the shooting incident recently that's causing so much anger among Iraqis. There has not been a shooting incident like that in Afghanistan so far. The company that had the contract before is called DynCorp International. There was a lot of criticism of their guards, that they were overly aggressive. At one point, there were American DynCorp guards guarding Afghan President Hamid Karzai. That was seen as sort of humiliating for Karzai to have Americans protecting him. And just broadly speaking, contractors dominate the American reconstruction, security, and training effort in Afghanistan and Iraq to an extent that's never been seen before. You know, Europe and Japan after World War II, that was largely the army and government officials carrying out these things. Everything is being subcontracted from education reform to reforming the Afghan judicial system to helping train, you know, the Afghan finance ministry to collect taxes. It's all carried out now by private contracting firms. Proponents say that this leads to more efficiency. Critics and some Afghans say it's a lot of companies making a lot of money and not necessarily producing the best quality work.
Hmm. Now, there have been civilian casualties and an uproar over that. I think most recently, well, NATO is now in charge of security operations. Is that correct?
It is, but it's a very convoluted command chain, and there's been criticism from NATO that American Special Forces soldiers or American units in general have called in airstrikes too quickly. So it's, NATO is sort of, they'll say they're not as aggressive with air power and that NATO is actually more cautious in terms of civilian casualties. But to average Afghans, Americans, or NATO, you know, they're all seen as foreign troops, and there's a real sense that far too many civilians have died. The numbers are very difficult to come by, but one fairly accurate Western or Taliban, a Western organization in Kabul, said at least 300 Afghans had died in airstrikes so far this year.
Now, there also have been a larger number of suicide bombings. You report at least 103 suicide bombings in the first 8 months of this year. This is something that seemed to have been imported from Iraq, perhaps, at least that's a sense I get, that it was not, you know, there were no suicide bombings in previous, you know, the previous eras of conflict in Afghanistan.
Yeah, Afghans, like during the attacks on the Soviets, there were not, it was not a common tactic. And the suicide bombings are part of, and even the attempt to have the American troops in terms of harming civilians, it's all part of a strategy where you're basically making Western troops extremely nervous about suicide bombers being around them at all times, or roadside bombs, which will, you know, sometimes there's egregious killing of civilians that isn't justified at all. Other times there's an attack and the American or NATO forces will overreact. And it's part of this asymmetric warfare that, you know, the U.S. faces today, both in Afghanistan and Iraq, where it takes a very small number of people. They don't need large amounts of popular support to carry out suicide bombings and roadside bombings. One change in Taliban tactics that I heard about this summer was that Afghans said that they now sleep in houses and in civilian buildings to try to draw, you know, if there is a bomb attack, they'll die, but the civilians will die as well. So it's part of a tactic to kind of alienate the population from NATO and U.S. forces that is working in some ways.
I'm also curious about the connection between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and if there is a direct sort of correlation, if they're different, you know, sort of groups of people. It seems that in the same way that perhaps, you know, NATO and U.S. forces are lumped together in one category, maybe we do the same thing, and I'm trying to sort of pull those threads apart, if you can shed any light on that.
The Al-Qaeda has pushed very hard for the increase in suicide bombings. Their leadership, which is widely believed to be in Pakistan, just over the border in what's called the Pakistani tribal areas, that's where most of the training camps are for suicide bombers that are coming into Afghanistan. There's also believed to be financial support that goes from Al-Qaeda to, you know, Afghan Taliban that sort of lead the Taliban on the ground. And then over the last, this summer, there's been many more foreign jihadists coming in from neighboring countries into Afghanistan, from Pakistan, from Uzbekistan, from Chechnya, and that's again seen as sort of an Al-Qaeda kind of guidance and facilitation role, where they're bringing in more of these foreign fighters who act as suicide bombers and carry out various attacks. They're also generally seen by Afghans as more extreme, the foreign fighters, and more willing to kill any civilian that's cooperating with the Afghan government.
We have a couple calls to include in our conversation. Let me just mention again our guest during this hour, Focus 580, David Rode, investigative journalist for the New York Times, and we're talking about his reporting from Afghanistan. David Rode is also the author of a book called Endgame, The Betrayal and Fall of Srebrenica, which won the Pulitzer Prize, among other things. And if you would like to join our conversation, we have a couple people waiting. We'll welcome others as well in the remaining 20 minutes or so. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Someone in Champaign, line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. I wonder if the guest is familiar with a book called Charlie Wilson's War. I don't remember the author, unfortunately.
Yes, I am.
Okay. Now, the thing that puzzled me, it was about the way in which we sponsored the Mujahideen, and I suppose that included bin Laden at the time. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. The thing that fascinated me about it was Congressman Wilson was a congressman from Texas, I believe, and he had a seat on the Appropriations Committee. And from that seat, he was apparently able to control very large American dollars without their going through what we might call the usual appropriations procedures. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay. And how exactly did that work? I mean, I know he worked with the CIA, and also... were those earmarks? We hear a great deal about earmarks these days. Or was it some other route that he used to make those funds available?
I have, to be honest, read parts of the book, but not the whole book. But it's basically from his position with the purse strings or whatever, he was able to, since even the CIA would depend on him for funding, he was able to, had tremendous power, you know, repeatedly visited the area, was able to, you know, send money to the different Mujahideen commanders that he supported. Mm-hmm. You know, what you're saying is correct, that there was a lot of questions about accountability and how one person was able to dominate the
effort. Exactly, and I guess my real question is that sort of thing going on again now?
A colleague of mine just did a story the other day saying that they're looking into at least $6 billion in the military funding and checking it for it being misspent in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't think there's one official in Congress that is quite as dominant as he was, mm-hmm. Given the sort of changeover in the last elections. But there is a sense of... and this somewhat gets into the contracting issue, that the amount of money the U.S. is spending in Iraq and Afghanistan, like the U.S. Agency for National Development or even the Pentagon, has had their budgets double or triple, but the staff they have to oversee the spending has remained the same. And so tremendous amounts of money are going to contractors, tremendous amounts of responsibility is going to contractors, but there's very little oversight of what they're doing.
Okay, thank you very much. That's depressing, but I'm glad at least to get a line on it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We'll continue on and talk with someone in Champaign again, line number two. Good morning.
Yes, I never hear the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, President Bush, talk much about Afghanistan, maybe because he figures that we all think about if we had been more focused on Afghanistan, we'd have Osama bin Laden dead or alive. But my question to you is, he always uses these talking points, and I'm paraphrasing, about Iraq. That is, we can democratize Iraq and make it be a jewel of the Middle East, and we created a democracy that can stand on its own, maintain itself, and defend itself. And when it steps down, we'll step out, or something to that effect. Applying those vague standards to Afghanistan, how does it square under Prime Minister Karzai at the present time? Is it being, quote, democratized? Can it stand for on its own, defend itself? And when we step down, it can step up, or words to that effect?
It's, to be frank, I've had American generals talk about Korea, which took, you can argue, anywhere from 15 to 20 to 30 years for the U.S. to stabilize after the war there in the early 50s, that's the length of time you're looking at. And there is progress. There's an Afghan National Army that's a mix of ethnic groups and is fairly professional, but it's still small. It's about 50,000 soldiers, but I've seen these guys come into villages, and Afghans are excited to see a professional army that isn't just from their tribe or ethnic group, and they want that. It is just an incredibly slow process. A lot of this stuff, it may depress callers, is basic economic development and modernizing countries, the same issue that the U.S. has sort of been dealing with a lot since World War II. It's worked well in some places. Korea would be, you know, one success story. It's been slower in other parts of the world. And, you know, there is progress in Afghanistan, but, you know, to be honest, we're talking at least another 10-year, you know, slowly reducing American troop presence. There is progress there, you know, more so than Iraq.
Hope it gets to the caller's question. We have another caller waiting, but I want to just interject because it leads directly into a question that I had on my list. In a major report published in the New York Times just over a week ago on August 12th, you write about the promise in 2002 of something like a Marshall Plan for Afghanistan. And indeed, President Bush invoked General Marshall and the rebuilding of Europe when he spoke about our plans for rebuilding Afghanistan. What happened?
It never happened. There's debate about why, but in both Iraq and Afghanistan, the United States has really struggled with the non-military side of stabilizing these countries. Training police, for example, has been enormously important, and we made very small efforts in the beginning in both countries. There's now massive efforts in both countries to try to, you know, and this is a very basic sort of pillar of a functioning government. Economic development's gone slower than expected in both countries. And I was just out with an American military unit, and the new counterinsurgency strategy in Iraq and Afghanistan is focused on less combat operations, more reconstruction, more, you know, helping local Afghan government officials, you know, deliver security and functioning schools and health clinics. It's all, you know, there's a realization that it's not going to be won militarily. If I'm going on too long, but
sorry.
The very basic thing is it's a competition between Al-Qaeda saying hardline Islamic law will deliver, again, good schools, steady jobs, and security, and moderate Muslims backed by the U.S. saying, you know, no, we can deliver it through our own sort of new systems of, you know, a sort of Afghan version of democracy, which has gone fairly well politically, you know, and a free market and, you know, interacting with the outside world instead of being isolated from it. And that's the competition. It's which system will deliver those very basic things that I think Afghans or, you know, Iraqis and even Americans are looking for. And we're getting better at delivering the non-military side, but we need to, you know, continue to work very, very hard at that.
We have a couple callers waiting. We'll go next to an Urbana listener on line number one. Good morning.
Hello. The parallel with Korea keeps coming up. And it seems to me it completely overlooks the fact that we entered Korea when Korea was being invaded by an outside force, or at least the North Koreans, and there was opposition to that in Korea, and we came in as allies and stayed there more or less that way, although there was considerable opposition to our presence from time to time. We entered Iraq not as supporting an extant government, but as an invader, and one which had been really attacking Iraq for the previous 10 years. It seems to me that any parallels that exist would be more apt to be that of the British in the 20s and 30s, when they fought the Iraqis continuously until they ultimately were driven out by a combination of Iraqi resistance and the Second World War. It seems to me very, very unlikely they are ever going to be our allies, or that the resistance to our presence will end as long as we are there, and that we are very chiefly a major recruiting agent for the for Al-Qaeda. Would you care to comment?
In terms of Iraq, I was there when Saddam Hussein fell in 2003, and there was no question that at that time most Iraqis, particularly Shias who'd been oppressed, were very happy to see him go. You're correct that there was no existing opposition government. And very quickly we were viewed as foreign occupiers. And again, I haven't spent as much time in Iraq recently, but I know that moderate Iraqis that had hoped for a sort of modern secular Iraq don't want U.S. troops there, but also fear what will unfold if the U.S. leaves. And it's, you know, there are still mixed areas in parts of the country, and moderate Iraqis see themselves trapped between hardline Sunnis and hardline Shias, and that if we do go, you're looking at a sort of scale of civil war as what unfolded in Afghanistan through the 80s, Beirut prior to that, and, you know, Bosnia as well. And it's whether or not it was a mistake to go in, it's simply leaving. You know, you may have even more extremists emerging from that kind of vicious civil war. And then lastly, Afghanistan is a different situation. There was an opposition party in the north. They were able to come in and establish control of at least large parts of the north and west. And it's, you know, we still retain, I think, popular support in Afghanistan. And I think the latest poll shows about 70% of Afghans supporting the U.S. presence. And the very basic thing between Iraq and Afghanistan would be the reason Afghans want a foreign presence is because they're afraid of civil war again. They're afraid of all the warlords and factions fighting each other and the chaos reemerging. And they see an international force as a way to kind of hold off that from happening. In many ways, Afghanistan is a post-civil war society and a society that's lived under hardline Islam and doesn't want either of those things back again. Iraq, you could argue, hasn't been through civil war yet and hasn't been through actually living under hardline Islamic law. And people may, you know, be confident they can win a civil war. Others may think that living under Sharia will, you know, bring everything that's promised. But in Afghanistan, they don't see those things.
We have several people lined up to talk. I mean, only just about 6 minutes left. We'll try to get to everyone, and if we can, we'll go next to someone on a cell phone, line number two. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Good morning.
I can't remember where I read this at. It may have been in Jim Marr's book, but it was only mentioned briefly, and it has to do with UNITAL and this pipeline they were going to install through Afghanistan. Anything you know about that, I'd appreciate it. I think what it said was they were nervous, UNITAL was nervous that the Taliban wouldn't be able to protect that pipeline. And did that pipeline ever get installed, and is it possible that that would have anything to do with our military action currently?
The UNICAL pipeline was a proposal to the Taliban government. This was when the U.S. did have some. This was pre-9/11, and there was talks between the U.S. and the Taliban about this. It would bring natural gas from Central Asia down across Afghanistan into Pakistan and India. There's some theories and a lot of stuff on the web that this is all about the U.S. building that pipeline. The pipeline's still not built. We've had 6 years to do it. There's not much interest in it because it's seen as a very dangerous investment, and it would help Afghanistan in terms of developing fees for moving the gas, but it's nowhere near, you know, the moneymaker that, you know, oil in Iraq would generate, if that's the suspicion I hear from people. So I just heard an American official ask about this when I was there last week. It has not been built yet. There's no plans to build it, and the country's still seen as too insecure. And I think the U.S. has spent it. The amount of money we're spending there, the profit levels wouldn't pay for it, you know, in any near time. I do think the majority of the reason U.S. troops are there is because of a fear of Al Qaeda reestablishing itself and launching more international attacks. It's just Afghanistan does not have the resources Iraq does.
Hope it gets the caller's question. We'll go next to someone in Fisher, line number one. Good morning.
Morning. I wonder. You mentioned Bosnia just in passing, and I wonder if there's a distinction, right, in the fact that in Bosnia, as you know better than I'm sure, the Muslims were victims of the Serbian people, not. Well, you know, some elements of serving people, and not insurrection at all, right? Isn't that true?
That's generally true, yeah, that the Serbs, Yugoslavia broke up and the Serbs tried to create a greater Serbia, and they were trying to push all the Muslims out of
Less
Serb areas, you know, and create a greater Serbia. That's where the ethnic cleansing idea came out, and there's fears that in Iraq you'd have the same things with Shia trying to push Sunnis out of all areas, and that did. There was attempts to do that in Afghanistan, and generally you see that it's much harder and bloodier than people expect, and it's not easy for one ethnic group to just drive the other out. Civil wars are always longer and messier than you know each side thinks it's going.
As a clarification, would you agree that, like, the Serbians were, in large measure, say 90% of the casualties were Muslims, so they were really the aggressors in that area? Would you agree with that?
I would say that, yeah, I don't know if 90% of the casualties, but particularly Slobodan Milosevic, who sort of sold average Serbs, on this idea of a greater Serbia, it'll be easy to do. You know, most of the civilians, most of the people who died were Muslims, yeah, during the war in Bosnia.
I'm sorry to say we have literally just about 2.5 minutes left, and there's so much more we could talk about. We didn't get to Pakistan at all, but we'll take that up on another day. I did want to ask you, David Rode, now we do have 23,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, and we're spending something like $3.5 billion per year on reconstruction there. The question is, how do these numbers relate to the scale of the situation in terms of actually addressing the needs of Afghanistan?
I would say that the U.S. troop numbers are about right now. We had many too few of them. There was only about 8,000 in the beginning. There was this belief pushed by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld to have a very light footprint and let the Afghans secure the country themselves. That didn't work. They just didn't have the resources to do it. And the whole key is training Afghan forces, particularly Afghan police, to secure the country, and expanding out the Afghan army. We will never be able to stabilize Afghanistan. Only Afghans can. And the whole key in Afghanistan and Iraq and Lebanon and different countries is there a more effective way for the United States to sort of strengthen and back moderates? And there are moderate Afghans. they do want a modern, moderate country, and it's, you know, is there a better and smarter way for us to do it? Again, I think we're making strides in that direction, but we, you know, we have to work harder on the non-military side.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, and with thanks to our guest, David Rode, investigative journalist for The New York Times, who has spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, among other places. His last name, by the way, is spelled R-O-H-D-E, pronounced Rode. You can also look for his book, Endgame, The Betrayal and Fall of Srebrenica, Europe's Worst Massacre Since World War II, which was published in 1997 and won the Pulitzer Prize. And I guess, David, for a book on Afghanistan you're going to be writing coming up.
That's true. And just one clarification, sure. The stories I wrote for the Christian Science Monitor won the Pulitzer Prize, not the book.
Okay.
But anyway, thank you for mentioning the book. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.